The lean-to at the side of the church had to be the priest's house. It had one shuttered window. The door stood open. They went in. There was a fire in the middle of the single room. The place was furnished with a rough-hewn table, a few stools, and a beer barrel in the corner. The floor was strewn with rushes. Near the fire, a man sat on a chair drinking from a large cup. He was a small, thin man of about 50 years, with a red nose and wispy grey hair. He wore ordinary everyday clothes, a dirty undershirt with a brown tunic, and clogs.
"Father Rafe?" said Richard dubiously.
"What if I am?" he replied.
Aliena sighed.
Why did people manufacture trouble when there was already so much of it in the world? But she had no energy left for dealing with bad temper, so she left it to Richard, who said,
"Does that mean yes?"
The question was answered for them. A voice from outside called, "Rafe, are you in?" A moment later, a middle-aged woman came in and gave the priest a hunk of bread and a large bowl of something that smelled like meat stew. For once, the smell of meat did not make Aliena's mouth water. She was too numb even to be hungry. The woman was probably one of Rafe's parishioners, for her clothes were of the same poor quality as his own. He took the food from her without a word and began to eat. She glanced incuriously at Aliena and Richard and went out again. Richard said,
"Well, Father Rafe, I am the son of Bartholomew, the former Earl of Shiring."
The man paused in his eating and looked up at them. There was hostility in his face and something else Aliena could not read. Fear? Guilt? He returned his attention to his dinner, but mumbled, "What do you want with me?" Aliena felt a tug of fear.
"You know what I want," Richard said. "My money. 50 bezants.
"I don't know what you're talking about," Rafe said. Aliena stared at him incredulously. This could not be happening. Father had left money for them with this priest. He had said so. Father did not make mistakes about such things. Richard had gone white. He said,
"What do you mean?"
"I mean, I don't know what you're talking about. Now piss off." He took another spoonful of stew. The man was lying, of course, but what could they do about it? Richard pressed on stubbornly.
"My father left money with you, 50 bezants. He told you to give it to me. Where is it?"
"Your father gave me nothing."
"He said he did."
"He lied, then." That was one thing you could be sure father had not done. Aliena spoke for the first time.
"You're the liar, and we know it."
Rafe shrugged. "Complain to the sheriff."
"You'll be in trouble if we do. They cut off the hands of thieves in this city."
The shadow of fear briefly crossed the priest's face, but it was gone in a moment, and his reply was defiant. "It will be my word against the word of a jailed traitor, if your father lives long enough to give evidence." Aliena realized he was right. There would be no independent witnesses to say that father had given him the money, for the whole idea was that it was a secret, money that could not be taken away by the king or Percy Hamley or any of the other carrion crows who flocked around the possessions of a ruined man. Things were just as they had been in the forest, Aliena realized bitterly. People could rob her and Richard with impunity, because they were the children of a fallen noble.
"Why am I frightened of these men?" she asked herself angrily. "Why aren't they frightened of me?"
Richard looked at her and said in a low voice,
"He's right, isn't he?"
"Yes," she said venomously.
"There's no point in our complaining to the sheriff."
She was thinking of the one time men had been afraid of her, in the forest, when she had stabbed the fat outlaw, and the other one had run away in fear. This priest was no better than the outlaw. But he was old and quite feeble, and he had probably counted on never having to face his victims. Perhaps he could be frightened.
Richard said, "What shall we do then?"
Aliena gave in to a sudden, furious impulse.
"Burn down his house," she said.
She stepped to the middle of the room and kicked the fire with her wooden clogs, scattering burning logs. The rushes around the fireplace caught immediately.
"Hey!"
Rafe yelled.
He half rose from his seat, dropping his bread and spilling the stew in his lap. But before he could get to his feet, Aliena was on him. She felt completely out of control. She acted without thinking. She pushed him, and he slipped off the chair and tumbled to the floor. She was astonished at how easy it was to knock him down. She fell on him, landing with her knees on his chest and winding him. Mad with rage, she thrust her face close to his and screamed, "You lying, thieving, godless heathen! I'm going to burn you to death!" His eyes flicked to one side, and he looked even more terrified. Following his glance, Aliena saw that Richard had drawn his sword and was holding it, ready to strike. The priest's dirty face went pale, and he whispered, "You're a devil. You're the one who steals money from poor children." Out of the corner of her eye she saw a stick with one end burning brightly. She picked it up and held the hot end close to his face. "Now I'm going to burn out your eyes, one by one. First, the left eye."
"No, please," he whispered. "Please don't hurt me."
Aliena was thrown by the rapidity with which he crumbled. She realized that the rushes were burning all around her.
"Where's the money, then?"
she said in a voice which suddenly sounded normal. The priest was still terrified.
"In the church."
"Where, exactly?"
"Under the stone behind the altar."
Aliena looked up at Richard.
"Guard him while I go and look," she said. "If he moves, kill him."
Richard said,
"Ali, the house will burn down."
Aliena went to the corner and lifted the lid of the barrel. It was half full of beer. She grasped the rim and pulled it over. Beer flowed all over the floor, soaking the rushes and putting out the flames. Aliena walked out of the house. She knew she really had been ready to put out the priest's eyes. But instead of feeling ashamed, she was overwhelmed by a sense of her own power. She had resolved not to let people make her a victim, and she had proved she could keep her resolution. She strode up to the front of the church and tried the door. It was fastened with a small lock. She could have gone back to the priest for the key, but instead she drew the dagger from her sleeve, inserted the blade in the crack of the door, and broke the lock. The door swung open and she marched inside. It was the poorest kind of church. There was no furniture other than the altar and no decoration except for some crude paintings on the lime-washed wood of the walls. In one corner a single candle flickered beneath a small wooden effigy, which presumably represented St. Michael. Aliena's triumph was disturbed for a moment by the realization that £5 presented a terrible temptation to a man as poor as Father Rafe. Then she put sympathy out of her mind. The floor was earth, but there was a single large stone slab behind the altar. It made a rather obvious hiding place, but of course no one would bother to rob a church as visibly poor as this. Aliena went down on one knee and pushed the stone. It was very heavy and did not move. She began to feel anxious. Richard could not be relied upon to keep Rafe quiet indefinitely. The priest might get away and call for help, and then Aliena would have to prove that the money was hers. Indeed, that might be the least of her worries now that she had attacked a priest and broken into a church. She felt a chill of anxiety as she realized that she was on the wrong side of the law now. That frisson of fear gave her extra strength. With a mighty heave, she moved the stone an inch or two. It covered a hole about a foot deep. She managed to move the stone a little farther. Inside the hole was a wide leather belt. She put her hand in and drew the belt out. "There," she said aloud, "I've got it." It gave her great satisfaction to think that she had defeated the dishonest priest and retrieved her father's money. Then, as she stood up, she realized that her victory was qualified. The belt felt suspiciously light. She unfastened the end and tipped out the coins. There were only 10 of them. 10 bezants were worth a pound of silver. What had happened to the rest? Father Rafe had spent it. She became enraged again. Her father's money was all she had in the world, and a thieving priest had taken 4/5 of it. She marched out of the church, swinging the belt. On the street, a passer-by looked startled when he caught her eye, as if there was something odd about her expression. She took no notice and went into the priest's house. Richard was standing over Father Rafe with his sword at the priest's throat. As Aliena came through the door, she screamed, "Where's the rest of my father's money?" "Gone," the priest whispered. She knelt by his head and put her knife to his face. "Gone where?" "I spent it," he confessed, in a voice hoarse with fear. Aliena wanted to stab him, or beat him, or throw him into a river. But none of it would do any good. He was telling the truth. She looked at the overturned barrel. A drinking man could get through a great deal of beer. She felt as if she might explode with frustration. "I'd cut off your ear if I could sell it for a penny," she hissed at him. He looked as if he thought she might cut it off anyway. Richard said anxiously, "He spent the money. Let's take what we've got and go." He was right, Aliena realized reluctantly. Her anger began to evaporate, leaving behind a residue of bitterness. There was nothing to be gained by frightening the priest any more, and the longer they stayed, the more chance there was that someone would come in and cause trouble. She stood up. "All right," she said. She put the gold coins back in the belt and buckled it around her waist beneath her cloak. She pointed a finger at the priest. "I may come back one day and kill you," she spat. She went out. She strode away along the narrow street. Richard caught up with her, hurrying. "You were wonderful, Ali," he said excitedly. "You scared him half to death, and you got the money." She nodded. "Yes, I did," she said sourly. She was still tense, but now that her fury had abated, she felt deflated and unhappy. "What shall we buy?" he said eagerly. "Just a little food for our journey. Shan't we buy horses?" "Not with a pound." "Still, we could get you some boots." She considered that. The clogs tortured her, but the ground was too cold for bare feet. However, boots were expensive, and she was reluctant to spend the money so quickly. "No," she decided. "I'll live a few more days without boots. We'll keep the money for now." He was disappointed, but he did not dispute her authority. "What food shall we get?" "Horse bread, hard cheese, and wine." "Let's get some pies. They cost too much." "Oh." He was silent for a moment, then he said, "You're awfully grumpy, Ali." Aliena sighed. "I know." She thought, "Why do I feel this way? I should be proud. I brought us here from the castle. I defended my brother, I found my father, I got our money." "Yes, and I stuck a knife into a fat man's belly and made my brother kill him, and I held a burning stick to a priest's face, and I was ready to put his eyes out." "Is it because of father?" said Richard sympathetically. "No, it's not," Aliena replied. "It's because of me." Aliena regretted not buying the boots. On the road to Gloucester, she wore the clogs until they made her feet bleed. Then she walked barefoot until she could no longer stand the cold, whereupon she put the clogs on again. She found it helped not to look at her feet. They hurt more when she could see the sores and the blood. In the hill country there were a lot of poor smallholdings, where peasants grew an acre or so of oats or rye and kept a few scrawny animals. Aliena stopped on the outskirts of a village, when she thought they must be near Huntley, to speak to a peasant who was shearing a sheep in a fenced yard next to a low wattle and daub farmhouse. He had the sheep's head trapped in a wooden fixture like a stock's, and was cutting its wool with a long-bladed knife. Two more sheep waited uneasily nearby, and one that was already shorn was grazing in the field, looking naked in the cold air. "It's early for shearing," Aliena said. The peasant looked up at her and grinned good-humouredly. He was a young man with red hair and freckles, and his sleeves were rolled up, showing hairy arms. "Ah, but I need the money. Better the sheep go cold than I go hungry." "How much do you get?" "Penny a fleece, but I have to go to Gloucester to get it, so I lose a day in the field, just when it's spring and there's a lot to do." He was cheerful enough, despite his grumbling. "What's this village?" Aliena asked him. "Strangers call it Huntley," he said. Peasants never used the name of their village. To them it was just the village. Names were for outsiders.
"Who are you?"
he asked with frank curiosity. "What brings you here?"
"I'm the niece of Simon of Huntly,"
Aliena said.
"Indeed. Well, you'll find him in the big house. Go back along this road a few yards, then take the path through the fields."
"Thank you."
The village sat in the middle of its ploughed fields, like a pig in a wallow. There were 20 or so small dwellings clustered around the manor house, which was not much bigger than the home of a prosperous peasant. Aunt Edith and Uncle Simon were not very wealthy, it seemed. A group of men stood outside the manor house with a couple of horses. One of them appeared to be the lord. He wore a scarlet coat. Aliena looked at him more closely. It was 12 or 13 years since she had seen her Uncle Simon, but she thought this was he. She remembered him as a big man, and now he looked smaller, but no doubt that was because Aliena had grown. His hair was thinning, and he had a double chin, which she did not recall. Then she heard him say, "He's very high in the wither, this beast," and she recognized the rasping, slightly breathy voice. She began to relax. From now on they would be fed and clothed and cared for and protected. No more horse bread and hard cheese. No more sleeping in barns. No more walking the roads with one hand on her knife. She would have a soft bed and a new dress and a dinner of roast beef. Uncle Simon caught her eye. At first he did not know who she was.
"Look at this," he said to his men, "a handsome wench and a boy soldier to visit us."
Then something else came into his eyes, and Aliena knew he had realized they were not total strangers.
"I know you, don't I?" he said.
Aliena said, "Yes, Uncle Simon, you do." He jumped, as if scared by something.
"By the saints, the voice of a ghost!"
Aliena did not understand that, but a moment later he explained. He came over to her, peering hard at her, as if he were about to look at her teeth like a horse, and he said,
"Your mother had the same voice, like honey pouring out of a jar. You're as beautiful as she was, too, by Christ!"
He put out his hand to touch her face, and she quickly stepped back out of reach.
"But you're as stiff-necked as your damned father, I can see that. I suppose he sent you here, did he?"
Aliena bristled. She did not like to hear father referred to as your damned father. But if she protested, he would take it as further proof that she was stiff-necked. So she bit her tongue and answered him submissively.
"Yes, he said Aunt Edith would take care of us."
"Well, he was wrong," Uncle Simon said. "Aunt Edith is dead. What's more, since your father's disgrace, I've lost half my lands to that fat rogue, Percy Hamley. It's hard times here, so you can turn right around and go back to Winchester. I'm not taking you in."
Aliena was shaken. He seemed so hard.
"But we're your kin," she said.
He had the grace to look slightly ashamed, but his reply was harsh.
"You're not my kin. You used to be my first wife's niece. Even when Edith was alive, she never saw her sister, because of that pompous ass your mother married."
"We'll work," Aliena pleaded. "We're both willing."
"Don't waste your breath," he said. "I'm not having you."
Aliena was shocked. He was so definite. It was clear there was no point in arguing with him or begging. But she had suffered so many disappointments and reverses of this kind that she felt bitter rather than sad. A week ago something like this would have made her burst into tears. Now she felt like spitting at him. She said,
"I'll remember this, when Richard is the Earl and we take the castle back."
He laughed.
"Shall I live so long?"
Aliena decided not to stay and be humiliated any longer.
"Let's go," she said to Richard. "We'll look after ourselves."
Uncle Simon had already turned away and was looking at the horse with the high wither. The men with him were a little embarrassed. Aliena and Richard walked away. When they were out of earshot, Richard said plaintively,
"What are we going to do, Ali?"
"We're going to show these heartless people that we're better than they are," she said grimly. But she did not feel brave. She was just full of hatred for Uncle Simon, for Father Rafe, for Odo Jailer, for the outlaws, for the Verderer, and most of all, for William Hamley.
"It's a good thing we've got some money,"
Richard said. It was, but the money would not last forever.
We can't just spend it, she said as they walked along the path that led back to the main road. If we use it all up on food and things like that, we'll just be destitute again when it's all gone. We've got to do something with it.
I don't see why, Richard said. I think we should buy a pony.
She stared at him. Was he joking? There was no smile on his face. He simply did not understand.
We've got no position, no title, and no land, she said patiently. The king won't help us. We can't get ourselves hired as laborers. We tried in Winchester, and no one would take us on.
But somehow we have to make a living and turn you into a knight.
Oh, he said. I see.
She could tell that he did not really see. We need to establish ourselves in some occupation that will feed us and give us at least a chance of making enough money to buy you a good horse.
You mean I should become an apprentice to a craftsman?
Aliena shook her head. You have to become a knight, not a carpenter. Have we ever met anyone who had an independent livelihood but no skills?
Yes, Richard said unexpectedly. Meg, in Winchester.
He was right. Meg was a wool merchant, although she had never been an apprentice.
But Meg has a market stall.
They passed the red-haired peasant who had given them directions. His four shorn sheep were grazing in the field, and he was tying their fleeces into bundles with cord made of reeds. He looked up from his work and waved. It was people such as he who took their wool into the towns and sold it to wool merchants, but the merchant had to have a place of business.
Or did he?
An idea was forming in Aliena's mind. She turned back abruptly. Richard said,
Where are you going?
She was too excited to answer him. She leaned on the peasant's fence. How much did you say you could get for your wool?
Penny a fleece, he said. But you have to spend all day going to Gloucester and back.
That's the trouble.
Suppose I buy your wool. That would save you the journey.
Richard said, Ally, we don't need wool.
Shut up, Richard.
She did not want to explain her idea to him now. She was impatient to try it out on the peasant. The peasant said, That would be a kindness. But he looked dubious, as if he suspected trickery. I couldn't offer you a penny a fleece, though. Aha! I thought there'd be a snag. I could give you tuppence for four fleeces.
But they're worth a penny each, he protested.
In Gloucester? This is Huntley. He shook his head. I'd rather have fourpence and lose a day in the field than have tuppence and gain a day.
Suppose I offer you threepence for four fleeces.
I lose a penny and save a day's journey. He looked bewildered. I never heard of nothing like this before.
It's as if I were a carter, and you paid me a penny to take your wool to market.
She found his slowness exasperating.
The question is an extra day in the fields worth a penny to you, or not?
It depends what I do with the day, he said thoughtfully.
Richard said, Ally, what are we going to do with four fleeces?
Sell them to Meg, she said impatiently, for a penny each. That way we're a penny better off.
But we have to go all the way to Winchester for a penny.
No, stupid. We buy wool from 50 peasants and take the whole lot to Winchester. Don't you see? We could make 50 pennies. We could feed ourselves and save up for a good horse for you. She turned back to the peasant. His cheerful grin had gone and he was scratching his ginger-coloured head. Aliena was sorry she had perplexed him, but she wanted him to accept her offer. If he did, she would know it was possible for her to fulfill her vow to her father. But peasants were stubborn. She felt like taking him by the collar and shaking him. Instead, she reached inside her cloak and fumbled in her purse. They had changed the gold bezants for silver pennies at the goldsmith's house in Winchester, and now she took out 3 pennies and showed them to the peasant.
Here, she said, take it or leave it.
The sight of the silver helped the peasant make up his mind.
Done, he said, and took the money.
Aliena smiled. It looked as if she might have found the answer. That night she used a bundled fleece for a pillow. The smell of sheep reminded her of Meg's house. When she woke up in the morning, she discovered that she was not pregnant. Things were looking up. 4 weeks after Easter, Aliena and Richard entered Winchester with an old horse pulling a homemade cart, bearing a huge sack which contained 240 fleeces, the precise number which made up a standard wool sack. At that point, they discovered taxes. Previously, they had always entered the city without attracting any attention, but now they learned why city gates were narrow and constantly manned by customs officers. There was a toll of 1 penny for every cartload of goods taken into Winchester. Fortunately, they still had a few pennies left, and they were able to pay, otherwise they would have been turned away. Most of the fleeces had cost them between 1/2 and 3/4 of a penny each. They had paid 72 pence for the old horse, and the rickety cart had been thrown in. Most of the rest of the money had been spent on food, but tonight they would have a pound of silver and a horse and cart. Aliena's plan was then to go out again and buy another sackful of fleeces, and to do the same again and again until all the sheep were shorn. By the end of the summer she wanted to have the money to buy a strong horse and a new cart. She felt very excited as she led their old nag through the streets toward Meg's house. By the end of the day she would have proved that she could take care of herself and her brother without any help from anyone. It made her feel very mature and independent. She was in charge of her own destiny. She had had nothing from the king, she did not need relatives, and she had no use for a husband. She was looking forward to seeing Meg, who had been her inspiration. Meg was one of the few people who had helped Aliena without trying to rob, rape, or exploit her. Aliena had a lot of questions to ask her about business in general and the wool trade in particular. It was market day, so it took them some time to drive their cart through the crowded city to Meg Street. At last they arrived at her house. Aliena stepped into the hall. A woman she had never seen before was standing there.
"Oh," said Aliena,
and she stopped short.
"What is it?" said the woman. "I'm a friend of Meg's."
"She doesn't live here any more,"
the woman said curtly.
"Oh, dear."
Aliena saw no need for her to be so brusque.
"Where has she moved to?"
"She's gone with her husband, who left this city in disgrace," the woman said.
Aliena was disappointed and afraid. She had been counting on Meg to make the sale of the wool easy.
"That's terrible news."
"He was a dishonest tradesman, and if I were you, I wouldn't boast about being a friend of hers. Now clear off."
Aliena was outraged that someone should speak ill of Meg.
"I don't care what her husband may have done. Meg was a fine woman and greatly superior to the thieves and whores that inhabit this stinking city," she said,
and she went out before the woman could think of a rejoinder. Her verbal victory gave her only momentary consolation.
"Bad news," she said to Richard. "Meg has left Winchester."
"Is the person who lives there now a wool merchant?" he said.
"I didn't ask. I was too busy telling her off."
Now she felt foolish.
"What shall we do, Ali?"
"We've got to sell these fleeces," she said anxiously.
"We'd better go to the marketplace."
They turned the horse around and retraced their steps to the high street, then threaded their way through the crowds to the market, which was between the high street and the cathedral. Aliena led the horse and Richard walked behind the cart, pushing it when the horse needed help, which was most of the time. The marketplace was a seething mass of people squeezing along the narrow aisles between the stalls, their progress constantly delayed by carts such as Aliena's. She stopped and stood on top of her sack of wool and looked for wool merchants. She could see only one. She got down and headed the horse in that direction. The man was doing good business. He had a large space roped off with a shed behind it. The shed was made of hurdles, light timber frames filled in with woven twigs and reeds, and it was obviously a temporary structure erected each market day. The merchant was a swarthy man whose left arm ended at the elbow. Attached to his stump, he had a wooden comb, and whenever a fleece was offered to him he would put his arm into the wool, tease out a portion with the comb, and feel it with his right hand before giving a price. Then he would use the comb and his right hand together to count out the number of pennies he had agreed to pay. For large purchases, he weighed the pennies in a balance. Aliena pushed her way through the crowd to the bench. A peasant offered the merchant 3 rather thin fleeces tied together with a leather belt.
"A bit sparse," said the merchant. 3 farthings each."
A farthing was 1/4 of a penny. He counted out 2 pennies, then took a small hatchet and, with a quick, practiced stroke, cut 1/3 penny into 1/4. He gave the peasant 2 pennies and 1 1/4.
3 times 3 farthings is 2 pence and 1/2.
The peasant took the belt off the fleeces and handed them over. Next, 2 young men dragged a whole sack of wool up to the counter. The merchant examined it carefully.
"It's a full sack, but the quality's poor," he said. "I'll give you 1 pound.
Aliena wondered how he could be so sure the sack was full. Perhaps you could tell with practice. She watched him weigh out 1 pound of silver pennies. Some monks were approaching with a huge cart piled high with sacks of wool. Aliena decided to get her business done before the monks. She beckoned to Richard, and he dragged their sack of wool off the cart and brought it up to the counter. The merchant examined the wool.
"Mixed quality," he said. "1/2 pound.
"What?" Aliena said incredulously.
120 pennies, he said.
Aliena was horrified. "But you just paid 1 pound for a sack."
"It's because of the quality."
"You paid 1 pound for poor quality."
"1/2 pound, he repeated stubbornly.
The monks arrived and crowded the stall, but Aliena was not going to move. Her livelihood was at stake, and she was more frightened of destitution than she was of the merchant.
"Tell me why," she insisted. "There's nothing wrong with the wool, is there?"
"Nope."
"Then give me what you paid those 2 men.
"Nope."
"Why not?"
she almost screamed.
"Because nobody pays a girl what they would pay a man."
She wanted to strangle him. He was offering her less than she had paid. It was outrageous. If she accepted his price, all her work would have been for nothing. Worse than that, her scheme for providing a livelihood for herself and her brother would have failed, and her brief period of independence and self-sufficiency would be over. And why? Because he would not pay a girl the same as he paid a man. The leader of the monks was looking at her. She hated people to stare at her.
"Stop staring," she said rudely. "Just do your business with this godless peasant."
"All right," the monk said mildly.
He beckoned to his colleagues, and they dragged up a sack. Richard said, "Take the 10 shillings, Ali. Otherwise we'll have nothing but a sack of wool."
Aliena stared angrily at the merchant as he examined the monk's wool.
"Mixed quality," he said. She wondered if he ever pronounced wool good quality.
1 pound and 12 pence a sack.
Why did it have to happen that Meg went away, thought Aliena bitterly. Everything would have been all right if she had stayed.
"How many sacks have you got?" said the merchant.
A young monk in novice's robes said,
10.
But the leader said,
"No, 11.
The novice looked as if he was inclined to argue, but he said nothing.
"That's 11.5 pounds of silver plus 12 pence.
The merchant began to weigh out the money.
"I won't give in,"
Aliena said to Richard. "We'll take the wool somewhere else. Shiring, perhaps, or Gloucester."
"All that way? And what if we can't sell it there?"
He was right. They might have the same trouble elsewhere. The real difficulty was that they had no status, no support, no protection. The merchant would not dare to insult the monks, and even the poor peasants could probably cause trouble for him if he dealt unfairly with them, but there was no risk to a man who tried to cheat 2 children with nobody in the world to help them. The monks were dragging their sacks into the merchant's shed. As each one was stashed, the merchant handed to the chief monk 1 weighed pound of silver and 12 pennies. When all the sacks were in, there was a bag of silver still on the counter.
"That's only 10 sacks, said the merchant.
"I told you there was only 10,
the novice said to the chief monk.
"This is the 11th, said the chief monk,
and he put his hand on Aliena's sack. She stared at him in astonishment. The merchant was equally surprised.
"I've offered her 1/2 pound, he said.
"I've bought it from her," the monk said.
"And I've sold it to you."
He nodded to the other monks, and they dragged Aliena's sack into the shed. The merchant looked disgruntled, but he handed over the last 1 pound bag and 12 more pennies. The monk gave the money to Aliena. She was dumbstruck. Everything had been going wrong, and now this complete stranger had rescued her, after she had been rude to him, too. Richard said, "Thank you for helping us, Father." "Give thanks to God," said the monk. Aliena did not know what to say. She was thrilled. She hugged the money to her chest. How could she thank him? She stared at her savior. He was a small, slight, intense-looking man. His movements were quick, and he looked alert, like a small bird with dull plumage but bright eyes. His eyes were blue, in fact. The fringe of hair around his shaved pate was black, streaked with grey, but his face was young. Aliena began to realize that he was vaguely familiar. Where had she seen him before? The monk's mind was going along the same path. "You don't remember me, but I know you," he said. "You're the children of Bartholomew, the former Earl of Shiring. I know you've suffered great misfortunes, and I'm glad to have a chance to help you. I'll buy your wool any time." Aliena wanted to kiss him. Not only had he saved her today, he was prepared to guarantee her future. She found her tongue at last. "I don't know how to thank you," she said. "God knows, we need a protector." "Well, now you have two," he said. "God and me." Aliena was profoundly moved. "You've saved my life, and I don't even know who you are," she said. "My name is Philip," he said. "I'm the Prior of Kingsbridge." Chapter 7 It was a great day when Tom Builder took the stone cutters to the quarry. They went a few days before Easter, 15 months after the old cathedral burned down. It had taken this long for Prior Philip to amass enough cash to hire craftsmen. Tom had found a forester and a master quarryman in Salisbury, where the Bishop Roger's palace was almost complete. The forester and his men had now been at work for 2 weeks, finding and felling tall pine trees and mature oaks. They were concentrating their efforts on the woods near the river, upstream from Kingsbridge, for it was very costly to transport materials on the winding mud roads, and a lot of money could be saved by simply floating the wood downstream to the building site. The timber would be roughly lopped for scaffolding poles, carefully shaped into templates to guide the masons and stone carvers, or, in the case of the tallest trees, set aside for future use as roof beams. Good wood was now arriving in Kingsbridge at a steady rate, and all Tom had to do was pay the foresters every Saturday evening. The quarrymen had arrived over the last few days. The master quarryman, Otto Blackface, had brought with him his two sons, both of whom were stone cutters, 4 grandsons, all apprentices, and 2 labourers, one his cousin and the other his brother-in-law. Such nepotism was normal, and Tom had no objection to it. A family group usually made a good team. As yet, there were no craftsmen working in Kingsbridge on the site itself, other than Tom and the priory's carpenter. It was a good idea to stockpile some materials, but soon Tom would hire the people who formed the backbone of the building team, the masons. They were the men who put one stone on another and made the walls rise. Then the great enterprise would begin. Tom walked with a spring in his step. This was what he had hoped for and worked toward for 10 years. The first mason to be hired, he had decided, would be his own son, Alfred. Alfred was 16 years old, approximately, and had acquired the basic skills of a mason. He could cut stone square and build a true wall. As soon as hiring began, Alfred would get full wages. Tom's other son, Jonathan, was 15 months old and growing fast. A sturdy child, he was the pampered pet of the whole monastery. Tom had worried a little at first about the baby being looked after by the half-witted Johnny Eightpence, but Johnny was as attentive as any mother, and had more time than most mothers to devote to his charge. The monks still did not suspect that Tom was Jonathan's father, and now they probably never would. 7-year-old Martha had a gap in her front teeth, and she missed Jack. She was the one who worried Tom most, for she needed a mother. There was no shortage of women who would like to marry Tom and take care of his little daughter. He was not an unattractive man, he knew, and his livelihood looked secure, now that Prior Philip was starting to build in earnest. Tom had moved out of the guest house, and had built himself a fine two-room house with a chimney in the village. Eventually, as master builder in charge of the whole project, he could expect a salary and benefits that would be the envy of many minor gentry. But he could not conceive of marrying anyone but Ellen. He was like a man who has got used to drinking the finest wine, and now finds that everyday wine tastes like vinegar. There was a widow in the village, a plump, pretty woman with a smiling face and a generous bosom, and two well-behaved children, who had baked several pies for him, and kissed him longingly at the Christmas feast, and would marry him as quick as he liked. But he knew that he would be unhappy with her, for he would always hanker after the excitement of being married to the unpredictable, infuriating, bewitching, passionate Ellen. Ellen had promised to come back one day to visit. Tom felt fiercely certain that she would keep that promise, and he clung to it stubbornly, even though it was more than a year since she had walked out, and when she did come back, he was going to ask her to marry him. He thought she might accept him now. He was no longer destitute. He could feed his own family and hers, too. He felt that Alfred and Jack could be prevented from fighting if they were handled right. If Jack were made to work, Alfred would not resent him so badly, Tom thought. He was going to offer to take Jack as an apprentice. The lad had shown an interest in building. He was as bright as a button, and in a year or so he would be big enough for the heavy work. Then Alfred would not be able to say that Jack was idle. The other problem was that Jack could read and Alfred could not. Tom was going to ask Ellen to teach Alfred to read and write. She could give him lessons every Sunday. Then Alfred would be able to feel every bit as good as Jack. The boys would be equal, both educated, both working, and before long, much the same size. He knew Ellen had really liked living with him, despite all their trials. She liked his body, and she liked his mind. She would want to come back to him. Whether he would be able to square things with Prior Philip was another matter. Ellen had insulted Philip's religion rather decisively. It was hard to imagine anything more offensive to a prior than what she had done. Tom had not yet solved that problem. Meanwhile, all his intellectual energy was employed in planning the cathedral. Otto and his team of stonecutters would build a rough lodge for themselves at the quarry, where they could sleep at night. When they were settled in, they would build real houses, and those who were married would bring their families to live with them. Of all the building crafts, quarrying required the least skill and the most muscle. The master quarryman did the brainwork. He decided which zones would be mined and in what order. He arranged for ladders and lifting gear. If a shear face was to be worked, he would design scaffolding. He made sure there was a constant supply of tools coming from the smithy. Actually, digging out the stones was relatively simple. The quarryman would use an iron-headed pickaxe to make an initial groove in the rock, then deepen it with a hammer and chisel. When the groove was big enough to weaken the rock, he would drive a wooden wedge into it. If he had judged his rock rightly, it would split exactly where he wanted. Laborers removed the stones from the quarry, either carrying them on stretchers or lifting them with a rope attached to a huge winding wheel. In the lodge, stonecutters with axes would hack the stones roughly into the shape specified by the master builder. Accurate carving and shaping would be done at Kingsbridge, of course. The biggest problem would be transport. The quarry was a day's journey from the building site, and a carter would probably charge fourpence a trip, and he could not carry more than 8 or 9 of the big stones without breaking his cart or killing his horse. As soon as the quarrymen were settled in, Tom had to explore the area and see whether there were any waterways that could be used to shorten the journey. They had set off from Kingsbridge at daybreak. As they walked through the forest, the trees arching over the road made Tom think of the piers of the cathedral he would build. The new leaves were just coming out. Tom had always been taught to decorate the cushioned capitals on top of the piers with scrolls or zigzags, but now it occurred to him that decorations in the shape of leaves would look rather striking. They made good time, so that by mid-afternoon they were in the vicinity of the quarry. To his surprise, Tom heard in the distance the sound of metal clanging on rock, as if someone was working there. Technically, the quarry belonged to the Earl of Shiring, Percy Hamley, but the king had given Kingsbridge Priory the right to mine it for the cathedral. Perhaps, Tom speculated, Earl Percy intended to work the quarry for his own benefit, at the same time as the priory worked it. The king probably had not specifically prohibited that, but it would cause a lot of inconvenience. As they drew nearer, Otto, a dark-skinned man with a rough manner, frowned at the sound, but he said nothing. The other men muttered to one another uneasily. Tom ignored them, but he walked faster, impatient to find out what was going on. The road curved through a patch of woodland and ended at the base of a hill. The hill itself was the quarry, and a huge bite had been taken out of its side by past quarrymen. Tom's initial impression was that it would be easy to work. A hill was bound to be better than a pit, for it was always less trouble to lower stones from a height than to lift them out of a hole. The quarry was being worked, no question of that. There was a lodge at the foot of the hill, a sturdy scaffold reaching 20 feet or more up the scarred hillside, and a stack of stones waiting to be collected. Tom could see at least 10 quarrymen. Ominously, there were a couple of hard-faced men-at-arms lounging outside the lodge, throwing stones at a barrel.
"I don't like the look of this," said Otto.
Tom did not like it either, but he pretended to be unperturbed. He marched into the quarry as if he owned it, and walked swiftly toward the two men-at-arms. They scrambled to their feet with the startled, faintly guilty air of sentries who have been on guard for too many uneventful days. Tom quickly looked over their weapons. Each had a sword and a dagger, and they wore heavy leather jerkins, but they had no armor. Tom himself had a mason's hammer hanging from his belt. He was in no position to get into a fight. He walked straight at the two men without speaking, then at the last minute turned aside and walked around them, and continued on to the lodge. They looked at one another, unsure what to do. If Tom had been smaller or had not had a hammer, they might have been quicker to stop him, but now it was too late. Tom went into the lodge. It was a spacious wood building with a fireplace. Clean tools hung around the walls, and there was a big stone in the corner for sharpening them. Two stone cutters stood at a massive wooden bench called a banker, trimming stones with axes. "Greetings, brothers," Tom said, using the form of address of one craftsman to another. "Who's the master here?"
"I'm the master quarryman," said one of them. "I'm Harold of Shiring."
"I'm the master builder at Kingsbridge Cathedral. My name is Tom."
"Greetings, Tom Builder. What are you here for?"
Tom studied Harold for a moment before answering. He was a pale, dusty man with small, dusty green eyes, which he narrowed when he spoke, as if he were always blinking away stone dust. He leaned casually on the banker, but he was not as relaxed as he pretended. He was nervous, wary, and apprehensive. "He knows exactly why I'm here," Tom thought. "I've brought my master quarryman to work here, of course." The two men-at-arms had followed Tom in, and Otto and his team had come in behind them. Now one or two of Harold's men also crowded in, curious to see what the fuss was about. Harold said, "The quarry is owned by the Earl. If you want to take stone, you'll have to see him." "No, I won't," Tom said. "When the king gave the quarry to Earl Percy, he also gave Kingsbridge Priory the right to take stone. We don't need any further permission."
"Well, we can't all work it, can we?"
"Perhaps we can," said Tom. "I wouldn't want to deprive your men of employment. There's a whole hill of rock, enough for two cathedrals and more. We should be able to find a way to manage the quarry, so that we can all cut stone here."
"I can't agree to that," said Harold. "I'm employed by the Earl."
"Well, I'm employed by the Prior of Kingsbridge, and my men start work here tomorrow morning, whether you like it or not." One of the two men-at-arms spoke up then.
"You won't be working here tomorrow or any other day."
Until this moment, Tom had been clinging to the idea that although Percy was violating the spirit of the royal edict by mining the quarry himself, if he was pushed, he would adhere to the letter of the agreement and permit the priory to take stone. But this man-at-arms had obviously been instructed to turn the priory's quarrymen away. That was a different matter. Tom realized, with sinking spirits, that he was not going to get any stone without a fight. The man-at-arms who had spoken was a short, stocky fellow of about 25 years, with a pugnacious expression. He looked stupid, but stubborn, the hardest type to reason with. Tom gave him a challenging look and said, "Who are you?"
"I'm a bailiff for the Earl of Shiring. He's told me to guard this quarry, and that's what I'm going to do."
"And how do you propose to do it?"
"With this sword."
He touched the hilt of the weapon at his belt.
"And what do you think the king will do to you when you're brought before him for breaking his peace?"
"I'll take my chances."
"But there are only two of you," Tom said in a reasonable tone of voice. "We're 7 men and 4 boys, and we have the king's permission to work here. If we kill you, we won't hang."
Both men-at-arms looked thoughtful, but before Tom could press his advantage, Otto spoke.
"Just a minute," he said to Tom. "I brought my people here to cut stones, not fight."
Tom's heart sank. If the quarrymen were not prepared to make a stand, there was no hope.
"Don't be so timid," he said. "Are you going to let yourselves be deprived of work by a couple of bully boys?"
Otto looked surly.
"I'm not going to fight armed men," he replied.
"I've been earning steadily for 10 years, and I'm not that desperate for work. Besides, I don't know the rights and wrongs of this. As far as I'm concerned, it's your word against theirs."
Tom looked at the rest of Otto's team. Both the stonecutters wore the same obstinate look as Otto. Of course, they would follow his lead. He was their father as well as their master, and Tom could see Otto's point. Indeed, if he were in Otto's position, he would probably take the same line. He would not get into a brawl with armed men unless he was desperate. But knowing that Otto was being reasonable gave Tom no comfort. In fact, it made him even more frustrated. He decided to give it one more try.
"There won't be any fighting," he said. "They know the king will hang them if they hurt us. Let's just make our fire and settle down for the night, and start work in the morning."
Mentioning the night was a mistake. One of Otto's sons said,
"How could we sleep with these murdering villains nearby?"
The others murmured agreement.
"We'll set watches," Tom said desperately.
Otto shook his head decisively.
"We're leaving tonight. Now."
Tom looked around at the men and saw that he was defeated. He had set out this morning with such high hopes, and he could hardly believe that his plans had been frustrated by these petty thugs. It was too galling for words. He could not resist a bitter parting shot.
"You're going against the king, and that's a dangerous business," he said to Harold. "You tell the Earl of Shiring that, and tell him that I'm Tom Builder of Kingsbridge, and if I ever get my hands around his fat neck, I might just squeeze it until he chokes."
Johnny Eightpence made a miniature monk's robe for little Jonathan, complete with wide sleeves and a hood. The tiny figure looked so fetching in it that he melted everyone's heart, but it was not very practical. The hood kept falling forward, obscuring his vision, and when he crawled, the robe got in the way of his knees. In the middle of the afternoon, when Jonathan had had his nap and the monks had had theirs, Prior Philip came across the baby with Johnny Eightpence in what had been the nave of the church and was now the novices' playground. This was the time of day when the novices were allowed to let off steam, and Johnny was watching them play tag while Jonathan investigated the network of pegs and cord with which Tom Builder had laid out the ground plan of the east end of the new cathedral. Philip stood beside Johnny for a few moments in companionable silence, watching the youngsters race around. Philip was very fond of Johnny, who made up for his lack of brains by having an extraordinarily good heart. Jonathan was on his feet now, leaning against a stake Tom had driven into the ground, where the north porch would be. He held on to the cord attached to the stake, and with that unsteady support took a couple of awkward, deliberate steps.
"He'll be walking soon," Philip said to Johnny.
"He keeps trying, Father, but he generally falls on his bottom."
Philip crouched down and reached out his hands to Jonathan.
"Walk to me," he said. "Come on."
Jonathan grinned, showing miscellaneous teeth. He took another step, holding on to Tom's cord. Then he pointed at Philip as if that would help, and with a sudden access of boldness he crossed the intervening space with three rapid, decisive steps. Philip caught him in his arms and said, "Well done!" He hugged him, feeling as proud as if the achievement were his, not the baby's. Johnny was equally excited. "He walked! He walked!" Jonathan struggled to be put down. Philip set him on his feet to see if he would walk again, but he had had enough for one day, and he immediately dropped to his knees and crawled to Johnny. Some of the monks had been scandalized, Philip recalled, when he had brought Johnny and baby Jonathan to Kingsbridge, but Johnny was easy to deal with so long as you did not forget that he was essentially a child in a man's body, and Jonathan had overcome all opposition by sheer force of personal charm. Jonathan had not been the only cause of unrest during that first year. Having voted for a good provider, the monks felt cheated when Philip introduced an austerity drive to reduce the priory's day-to-day expenses. Philip had been a little hurt. He felt he had made it clear that his top priority would be the new cathedral. The monastic officers had also resisted his plan to take away their financial independence, even though they knew perfectly well that without reforms the priory was headed for ruin. And when he had spent money on enlarging the monastery's flocks of sheep, there had almost been a mutiny. But monks were essentially people who wanted to be told what to do, and Bishop Walleran, who might have encouraged the rebels, had spent most of the year going to Rome and coming back, so in the end muttering was as far as the monks had got. Philip had suffered some lonely moments, but he was sure results would vindicate him. His policies were already bearing fruit in a very satisfying way. The price of wool had risen again, and Philip had already started shearing. That was why he could afford to hire foresters and quarrymen. As the financial position improved and cathedral building progressed, his position as prior would become unassailable. He gave Johnny eightpence, an affectionate pat on the head, and walked through the building site. With some help from priory servants and younger monks, Tom and Alfred had made a start on digging the foundations. However, they were only 5 or 6 feet deep as yet. Tom had told Philip that the foundation holes would have to be 25 feet deep in places. He would need a large force of laborers, plus some lifting gear, to dig so far down. The new church would be bigger than the old one, but it would still be small for a cathedral. A part of Philip wanted it to be the longest, highest, richest, and most beautiful cathedral in the kingdom, but he suppressed the wish and told himself to be grateful for any kind of church. He went into Tom's shed and looked at the woodwork on the bench. The builder had spent most of the winter in here, working with an iron measuring stick and a set of fine chisels, making what he called templates, wooden models for the masons to use as guides when they were cutting stones into shape. Philip had watched with admiration while Tom, a big man with big hands, precisely and painstakingly carved the wood into perfect curves and square corners and exact angles. Now Philip picked up one of the templates and examined it. It was shaped like the edge of a daisy, a quarter circle with several round projections like petals. What sort of stone needed to be that shape? He found that these things were hard to visualize, and he was constantly impressed by the power of Tom's imagination. He looked at Tom's drawings engraved on plaster in wooden frames, and eventually he decided that he was holding a template for the piers of the arcade, which would look like clusters of shafts. Philip had thought they would actually be clusters of shafts, but now he realized that would be an illusion. The piers would be solid stone columns with shaft-like decorations. 5 years, Tom had said, and the East End would be finished. 5 years, and Philip would be able to hold services in a cathedral again. All he had to do was find the money. This year it had been hard to scrape together enough cash to make a modest start, because his reforms were slow to take effect. But next year, after he had sold the new Springs wool, he would be able to hire more craftsmen and begin to build in earnest. The bell rang for vespers. Philip left the little shed and walked to the crypt entrance. Glancing over at the priory gate, he was astonished to see Tom Builder coming in with all the quarrymen. Why were they back? Tom had said he would be away for a week, and the quarrymen were to have stayed there indefinitely. Philip hurried to meet them. As he came close, he saw that they looked tired and dispirited, as if something terribly discouraging had happened. "What is it?" he said. "Why are you here?"